Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about some Enlist on your soybeans. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at some expansion on the part of Beck's Hybrids. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about Knee High by the 4th of July. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today is Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, both with Tilth Agronomy. Well, it is the 4th of July weekend here. Time to blow up a little piece of America in celebration.
The 4th on a Friday is awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, I think anytime it falls in that weekend, it makes for a nice break of things, and weather looks pretty good. They're talking a little bit of rain showers on the weekend here, but nothing too crazy.
For farmers, it can be tough. If you can take off for that later that day, say you got a picnic or fireworks, it's nice. But if you got to, sometimes there's also things, it's like you're wrapping up with second crop hay or spraying soybeans, or like it's kind of that wrap up time where you're like, man, I just need this one last day. But what I do like about the 4th of July is usually if you work, you know, what most people would still consider a full day. But for a farmer is like a half day.
Right.
like till 3-4 o'clock. You're
still good.
You know, you go out for, you know.
Can't set up fireworks till it's dark anyway.
Right. So everything starts at dusk. So that is nice where you got some of that day to take and get some work done and then some of it to enjoy, hopefully.
Yeah. No, I think tonight is fireworks somewhere, and there's fireworks usually for 4 or 5 nights around the 4th of July here. So it's just kind of there's lots of opportunities to go see some sort of fireworks, unless you set your own off, which that can be
doing a show this year, Matt?
Not this year. Don't.
All right. So,
but yeah, no, it's always a good time to get out and see some fireworks. So you going to some fireworks?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We'll go to usually just wherever. I would say depends on the year and what we're feeling. And
sure.
Certain years we've had where there were mistakes, or it was like you got to a spot and there's either just so many people or so much traffic that it was hard to get out of there. Where you're just like, nah, this isn't fun. What is neat is how many small towns actually have pretty good displays.
Yeah.
That you don't have to go to like a big city always to see. The big city ones can be cool, but they usually just go higher.
Right.
Now, I mean, they can have more fireworks, can be better, but
it feels like every year they get shorter. Like it's
they do, right.
Not like, but it's with the traffic and everything else, by the time you get there and you watch the fireworks, like, oh, time to get up and go again. Like, oh, all right, I feel like we just got here, but okay.
Do you like music with your fireworks, Matt?
I don't mind it. I don't need it.
Yeah, I like it. But it's like when you golf, which I don't golf much anymore, but it's weird not having music when you golf, I feel like, and fireworks.
Which is the opposite of most things when you think of golf.
Cause, well, right, you want it quiet. And
right. Professional golfers would get mad if you had music playing.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of it, though, too, is like it's almost a musical, like everything. You have a Bluetooth speaker, your phone that can play music anywhere now, or it's a little
You could just,
too much. But yeah, I like last year I brought a Bluetooth speaker, played 4th of July music while they were going. It's a good time.
What do you consider 4th of July music? Was it like the 1812 Overture?
This was I cheated and just found like a Sirius XM had a channel.
A preset.
And it was basically, just like Toby Keith a lot. And
so you don't have your own 4th of July playlist?
No, there was not.
Yeah, it was, okay.
It was pre-chosen playlist, so.
Okay. Here I thought maybe you were crafting like your perfect playlist of.
Yeah, you gotta. Well, and a lot of times the music too is there for like the lead. Because if you're going somewhere for fireworks, you usually gotta get there ahead of time before it's dark.
And right, if you want a decent spot.
You sit and just hang out there. And
then there's the try to find the secret spot where you can see the fireworks, but it's not like the busiest spot. But then other people figure it out too, and then you're like, oh no, this is just as busy. Like,
do you have a secret spot?
I don't, because I don't go to the big shows very much.
One we found for a big show was it's near, like, you park at a bowling alley and then you walk along some roads and then sit next to a gas station. So, me and my brother Nick are headed to that secret spot. He found that with his father-in-law. So, because we tried other spots at this fireworks, and one was the where we were like right in it a couple of years ago, like right where they, like, this was the Appleton fireworks show, and they got like an amphitheater where they play music.
Yep.
And then you sit on top of this big hill, which was really cool, but like got there early, got a good spot, and then just fills up with a ton of people.
Right.
Way too many people, like more than, and they had like food trucks, but the lines were huge. And then the worst was like the porta potties. Like, oh, it was not enough porta potties for the amount of people. And that was like right after COVID was coming back. Like, people were coming back. So I think it was probably more than,
sure,
obviously the previous couple of years, and maybe more than usual. And yeah, I was just like, no, this isn't, you're right, Matt. You need like that secret spot where it's
yeah,
a little less traffic. Like, you still see them good. Little less traffic and little less people. And I think country shows, you get that, which is great. Like all the, you know, the small town shows, you can definitely find that.
Yeah, I think the older I get and the older my kids get, the less tolerance I have for being stepped on by other people's kids in those situations. Just like, where are your parents? Why are you over by me? Just get away.
Yeah, usually like some super redneck family always sits by you and they're just...
There's just so many, so many opportunities in those crowds for things to be less than desirable.
Yep.
But, All right, well, are you ready to talk some E3 soybeans?
Yeah. I'm excited about this one. This has been, and we're wrapping up, you know, soybean spraying in general. We would have been wrapped up, but it rained and got rained out, so... For some of this, this tends to be of a little bit of, think about how your spray worked. So as you sprayed maybe your post soybean spray a couple of weeks ago or last week, and now is a good time to be watching, how did it work? What did it do? And reassess what your plan for next year is. So one of the things with E3 or Enlist soybeans adoption, and not that dicamba soybeans, we're not still using it in places. So Extend Flex, you can still use Liberty on those soybeans if you have Extend Flex. So something to consider as we're talking about all this. But the reason we went Enlist is that one with the adoption and that we can still use the Enlist herbicide is kind of becoming more and more common. And E3 basically means, you know, Roundup, Enlist, and Liberty or glufosinate. So what is cool is you get more choices. There's more to use. There's this sort of like more tools in the toolbox.
Right.
Which a couple of years ago, I was like super excited for. You know, I'm like, this is going to be great. We got more tools for Roundup resistant crops. This is exciting. More options is definitely better. However, the more options just means more choices. It is just...
Well, yeah, and, you know, it sounds great, but just like when we talk about fertilizer and soil amendments and all the other stuff, like, there might be 30 different things you can do, but if you try to do them all, that usually isn't the best option either.
Right.
So you have to be very selective about what you need versus just chucking everything in there.
No, it became like choice overload or analysis paralysis, where you're thinking of like, well, this field needs this and I want this field really could use this. And so we'll get into all the choices, but it's almost become too many, and you got to get back to this sort of keep it simple, stupid, because also like farmers or co-ops, whoever, got to be efficient for one, and
right,
for two, got to make it where it's not so complicated that something gets mixed up, literally mixed up. You know, you want it mixed up, but in the tank.
Right. You don't want to, not accidentally spray something you shouldn't have.
Right. And just, and all these don't always play nice together in that tank. So,
well, then you get, I guess the first step, though, before you even get that far, is to make sure you can spray
right
all these things in your beans. If you got high oleic beans or some of this other stuff that's not in this genetic family, you could make a big boo-boo. Or, you know, whoever's spraying, if they don't know, you've got different types of beans. So you got to be really specific about which right. fields can get these things.
First thing is know that you for sure have Enlist beans there.
Right.
Or what your trade options are. I like that, man, a lot. Because, yes, we don't want to get too far. So that's first step. The second step is reading the labels and tank mix partners, especially in this case for Enlist.
Yep.
You do want to read and make sure what you're throwing in there with it is on label and appropriate and add, you know, is okay to sort of spray together. So that is one spot where you do want to make sure you're watching that.
Yeah.
So one interesting one with that too, on the Liberty side, was with Cobra and Liberty. They're not those two, cause they're kind of more burners, if you will.
Right.
But guys that say use Cobra sort of as white mold control, you do want to make sure as you're like, if you want to throw it in with your Liberty, or you cannot, you know, it's not on label to be doing things.
Not
like
a good
that.
Tank mix partner.
So be watching that. It just all this week and last week as we're deciding, it got to be very tough. And as one good co-op guy put it, like spraying beans used to be easy.
Yep.
So maybe that this isn't the tougher, is that spraying beans used to be super easy, really. It was like, wait till weeds are popcorn height, spray Roundup. Like, that was what we, you know, in enough fields you got pre and everything just died easily. Like, I think that's part of the problem with all the choices now, isn't that it's before we didn't even need all these choices and it was easy. So
right.
Now it's just adding that these multiple layers of stuff that I actually think beans right now, and the particular co-op guy that told me that beans used to be easy, he sprays vegetable crops. He's spraying things that are harder to spray.
Right. Vegetables are, you get a sniff of the wrong thing. And
right. So when he's saying, I'd rather spray that than spray soybeans, that's showing you how
right.
how hard this has gotten to spray. So, and I agree with that. They're frustrating. Like from a ground standpoint, we're making recommendations. It's got even really hard to what to recommend because it's almost like we have so many different things we could prescribe, and knowing when to actually prescribe them and not, it's tougher that way.
Yeah, and the more things you're throwing in there, the more chance you have for some sort of interaction, antagonism, whatever you want to say. So just the kitchen sink approach isn't necessarily the best approach, because your chances are you're going to find something that's going to affect something else in that mix. So right. keeping it to what you need will hopefully help limit the amount of antagonism you might see in a tank mix.
So all that prequel, are we ready to talk the choices yet?
I think it's, we got to start somewhere.
Because right? I think all these farmers realize that, and what kind of having a good game plan. So say you sprayed already, maybe start making your game plan for next year already. Like, this is what worked. This is my plan A for next year, and go from there instead of, you know, obviously rehashing it every year, and you might have to change a few of the ingredients depending on your weeds next year, but that's something to think about. So the kind of all the options here, and we'll just start with Liberty only. Like, do you have just some weeds? Is it fairly clean that we can get away, you know, are the beans almost canopied? Can we get away with just sort of a shot of Liberty and we're good? So that'd be kind of that, I would almost call it the sort of bare minimum, almost going back to like the Roundup only days. This case, you'd have to have, you know, shorter weeds under 3 inches and very low density, almost those fields where it's like, well, this is so clean, I don't even know if I want to spray it. And that almost is the goal at this point, is be spraying fields that feel like you shouldn't even need to spray them. Like they're fairly clean.
Yep.
That means you did a good job with your pre or early post application to get to this side where your post is fairly clean. So then next step is like Enlist only, which you wouldn't do Enlist only because you're not going to get any grasses in the field. You just get broadleaf. So is it Enlist, Roundup? Is it Enlist with Clethodim or Select so you can get volunteer corn and grasses? So that's kind of the next option is sort of what is there a little bit more weed pressure, maybe some tougher weeds that you want to throw that Enlist in with that tank.
Right, you need that extra punch.
Yes, yep. And Liberty's got a punch, but this is kind of, like Matt said, that sort of extra punch. And then, as we're talking herbicides, then it becomes the, like, the trifecta. Do you need both or all three? Do you need Roundup, Liberty, and Enlist for some reason to really get a good
right
punch? And that right now, as you look at sort of university recommendations or like chemical salesman recommendations, it is all over the board, whether that's a little bit sort of too much. Are we, you know, kind of going overboard with that to like, no, that's a, if especially depending on the weed pressure, you obviously might have needed that, or this year where it got later and we're spraying kind of later than we wanted because you got rained out when you wanted to.
Right.
You
know, and the weeds just kept growing.
Right. They grew.
The rain.
Especially, it's amazing what a water hemp can grow in basically a week, but within days, it'll just all of a sudden go from being like, oh, yeah, you got some water hemp out there. It's going to be a problem, to a few days later going like, holy man, we got to get the sprayed right away and
right
make sure we throw more at it. So that one was odd to me because I had been odd in that. That's becoming more mainstream, but at the same time, there's certain people making recommendations out there that it didn't feel as mainstream as I thought. So I just thought that was a little odd. The Badger Crop Network, which is kind of the university and...
So they're all in one now. They
have, right.
The crop, all the crop aspects, your health... weeds, fertilization, it's all under one kind of umbrella now.
Which has got it's a super cool logo and a cool new, like, they've got, like, a little badger guy peeking over, and there's, like a crap scene underneath. It's kind of fun, and Rodrigo Worley and all the guys there are very good. Rodrigo's had a lot of good posts, but one came late June where he talks about to spray or not to spray a group 15, which would be a residual, with your post-pass of Enlist 1 and Liberty. So this, if you Google up that, you'll find it, and it's a very good article basically talking about what to do with that post-application and when you need a group 15 or not. And so what they basically ask is if you sprayed a very strong pre or early post, these are the four questions, and if you answer yes to all, we could actually skip the residual with it.
Sure.
So next thing we're kind of moving on is, do you need residual at that stage or not?
Is one of those questions your row with? Because that's usually where I fall with the residual side. Is
true. They,
in their 30s.
They talk more about canopy.
Right, which when is related to right row with, yeah.
Right. But yes, it's when... So did you spray a strong early pre, or did you have an early post out that you still might have a little residual out there? Is the soybean crop V4 or more advanced? Which a lot of these, as you get past V5, they're off label anyway.
Right.
But is your soybeans, you know, at a good enough stage? Especially from V3 to V4 is a big jump in kind of how much it branches and
yep
and where that bean's at. Is a soybean canopy on track to close within the next 2 weeks? Which I think is actually a very good question, because some of those you look at and you're like, man, it's not canopy, but yeah, within a week or two, it should be closed. But Matt, you're right, with 30-inch rows, one, some of your 30s never close. But on 30-inch rows, this question is definitely more important because it's just harder to get them to really branch out.
Right.
And then, are you seeing only established water hemp or new flushes? So are you seeing kind of a whole bunch of new little ones, or what you're seeing just those kind of bigger ones that were there? And basically, if you answered yes to all of those, then you can sort of skip the group 15, which would be your dual outlook Zidua SC kind of herbicides. So, and then if you answer no, then maybe you do want to keep it on there. One of the hard parts with those is they do, depending on the weather, depending on the height of the crop, a lot of things, but they do seem to, throwing those in the tank definitely does set back your beans or slows them down for a little while. There's a whole bunch of different things they, depending on one you pick, that they can do, but that is one struggle that they will set your beans back a little bit. So that's why answering that yes or no, it is helpful to try to decide whether you want to add that in. So whether you need the residual or not, please go to that Badger Crop Network and sort of read that article and try to decide what you want to do with that.
Yeah, and it is tough to make that decision sometimes because you're like, well, I'm making the pass, and you want to err on the side of not having to come back again for right. some reason. So
right, that one's one of like, can be regret. Like 2 weeks later, you go like, oh man, I should have just thrown it in. Now I got this breaking through or right. this problem. One good part is, especially if you're most of the time, them really late weeds don't affect as much as obviously the early ones. So
yeah.
And you're,
the water hemp one is the biggest one.
Right.
Because that can be August and then you can get
new
still
flushes.
Getting
these flushes. Right.
And it doesn't mean, you have to think about your history of the field
right.
too when it comes to this, because if you've been doing a good job of managing the water hemp over the years, your late flushes are probably less likely.
It's actually a good fifth question. Like, do you have a history of water hemp problems on this field
right.
or whatever weed problem, yes or no? Because if you're right, Matt, if you have very little history of a problem there, you're probably going to be fine. And you can even look at probably how much water hemp are there when you're spraying. If you have a lot, there's a good chance it's going to keep kind of coming in those flushes.
Yeah, because, I mean, if last year it was so wet, you never got in on time and you had a lot of stuff late, then maybe you're going to have some potential of that seed that was there that you didn't want to be there, but you couldn't control it as well last year to be there. But if you didn't have that, then you're probably a little bit on the safer side.
I did forget one group 15 was warrant.
Yep, so warrant. Would
I just
be
wanted
one.
To make sure I added that, you know, those are kind of your four choices in that residual late herbicide choices.
Oh, you're talking the herbicide. I thought you were talking the band warrant for your playlist.
for
4th of July spraying.
Do they have any good 4th of July songs?
I don't think so, but does it have to be a specific 4th of July song?
To be a 4th of July song, you gotta either mention America, which is sort of a weird, because some of these are just like very loosely mentioning America, but they're decent. Or it's got to be about, yeah, like, it's just sort of got to be about either a city in America mentioning America.
What's more American than Cherry Pie?
No, you're right. It's
warrant song,
you're
Cherry
right.
Pie. So, I mean, there's that. Sorry, got us off track.
And that band is, to me, a very specific.
Honestly, outside of She's My Cherry Pie, that's...
Would you almost consider them a one-hit wonder, or... I know they're not.
For our generation, yes.
Yeah, true.
Because they've... That is probably the most popular song that we are familiar with. But maybe some folks that are older than us would consider them not. Just trying to look through their other songs here. Nothing's really standing out. I'm sure I've heard more than that, but it's just one of those things where none of these names of the songs are like, oh, yeah
that's
setting something right there.
All right, so next up on the choices, so we're still only kind of halfway down the middle or half, but so obviously it's almost like a checkbox as you go here. Next one is, do you have volunteer corn that is Roundup corn? You know, so if you have conventional corn, Roundup will kill it, or Liberty will kill it, or Clethodim will still kill it. But so do you have volunteer Roundup Ready corn? The next question after that is, do you have volunteer Roundup Ready and Liberty corn?
Yeah, because then Liberty's not going to do
anything. So, so Liberty will take out volunteer Roundup Ready corn. Maybe not some big ones it doesn't do as well, but it'll take them out. But then if you have genetics the previous, so then it's looking back to your corn genetics from last year.
Right.
And seeing, okay, maybe, and most time when I've done that, it's not typically, some farms it is, but it's not typically where every field was Liberty or not. Sometimes it is, but so that's just tricky. Then usually we just spray a selector Clethodim and don't worry about it if we know enough of it is Liberty. But that is one nice thing, that you may not need the Clethodim in there if you have Roundup Ready only volunteer corn.
Yeah. And spraying Liberty on corn isn't as popular as spraying Liberty on beans. So sometimes you actually do have to look back at the label, just check to see if it was glufosinate tolerant or not, because you weren't worried about spraying it last year, but now you have to be worried about spraying it this year.
Correct. And just in general, if you have like a Corteva-based genetic corn, especially going on, all of them are going to be have the Liberty in there.
Yep.
If you have, you know, sort of any others besides that, you check your label, but most likely you didn't have Liberty corn.
Right.
So that's the next one of volunteer corn. How much is it? And then let's say you're going to use Clethodim, then it comes down to rate. So the Enlist, if you got Enlist in the tank with your Clethodim, it's antagonistic on the Clethodim, so it won't work as good. So you'll need more Clethodim to kill the volunteer corn. Most of the people say, you know, add 2 ounces. So say your normal rate's 8 ounces, go to 10, or add a couple. There's different ratios even I've heard that you need.
Yeah, but
you need 20 or 40% more. I don't know that any of those are like strong rules of thumb. What I would say is the old rule of thumb too is like by height of corn, that's how much, and obviously there's a top limit to that, that over about, say, 12 ounces, you're not going to do that, but say you had 6-inch corn, you could use 6 ounces of Clethodim. That was the old kind of version. Obviously, that sort of changed a little bit, but there was a time in there, too, where we just seemed like we had our time killing volunteer corn. Now we've upped the rates enough, and it's working fine in general. And that's the other part. We want to kill it, but as long as you set it back, the beans will grow past it and be fine. But so it's not only do you need it there, but then there's this antagonism part that you got to weigh in. So knowing if you got Liberty corn, Roundup Ready, volunteer corn, and then attacking that. So that's all the like herbicide options. Next step is adjuvants, and what do you need there? That also gets tricky. Certain herbicides like certain adjuvants a little bit more. So let's just talk about the specific ones here. Is Liberty, as far as adjuvant goes, you want, that one really likes AMS.
Yeah.
You want AMS. If it can be in dry form, that seems to be even better, working better, because it's treating your water, and it just, I've seen more dry bags of AMS on farms lately because of that. It really likes that. So you want your AMS there. And then when you get into your Enlist and Clethodim, that likes a little bit of oil with it. So some are using methylated seed oils, it seems, in general. And
enhances the burn.
Right. And then, but your Clethodims like your crop oils a little better. So that one, talk to your retailer or who you're buying from or the co-op and kind of what adjuvant, you know, they're using. But adjuvants gets really tricky there too, of like, which ones do you really need? You don't want too much where you're going to burn it really bad, and kind of loads, and that sort of a debate yet among the industry of how much is the right amount, what's too much, and kind of how to do that. And then really watch the rates on those, get tricky, because a lot of them are per 100 gallons. And so let's go next to that of water. When you're using Liberty, We want 20 gallons of water
right.
in that tank. Enlist and Roundup, you know, don't need that much, but Liberty definitely want 20 gallons of water. So out of those rates on your adjuvants are based on how much water you're using. So kind of making sure you get that correct, that you do the math and it ends up like, okay, you might have to do the math a couple times on that to make sure you're not way overdoing it or way underdoing
it. Right. You know, you want to be as close as you can to what you need.
Right. So then that adjuvants, like I said, consult labels. You're going to have to cross-check labels. I was doing a lot of that this week where, okay, this label says I want this, but this I don't really need that. But a lot of it ends up being like a hot MES and AMS. That seems to be, you know, so depending, like I said, where you're buying it from and kind of how we do that. But we do have noticed, like, when we were first using Enlist, we weren't using as much of those oils, and now we're using a little more and it's working better. So that making sure you got the right adjuvants there, and then the right amount of water with it. So, and then the final thing would be this. Then we got the piggybackers, I call them. So that's just your chem. And now, guys, well, I'm going out there anyway, and the beans are going to flower soon or whatever. I'm going to piggyback, whatever.
Fungicide.
Yeah.
Foliar feed.
Just plant growth regulators, depending, and just other, like, it. That list gets interesting. And that one's a tricky one, is if you're paying somebody to spray for you, you tend to want to not have to have them come back with those piggybackers. If you're spraying your own, you might want to watch your piggybackers and just do them at the right time when you know, like, I'm going to wait till R1 soybeans, I'm going to do my fungicide and this, you know, or yep. Well, we're so close to flowering that, or there's just made like that first flower on there that some guys throw these piggybackers on. But this, the amount of piggybackers gets not, I mean, there's the guys that are spraying are telling me, like, we're getting to be 8, 9, 10 things in this tank that I got to throw in. Like, there's hardly room for water. You know, like, that's
half right. The joke. Yeah, your ratios are all over the place.
Well, right. And you just get to be a lot. So sometimes that part too is just doing your best to keep it as simple and what is needed at that time in that tank, and either come back with your piggybackers and don't piggyback them, or just, you know, just be watching that. So it literally, what makes me laugh about the word piggyback is, have you ever tried to, like, piggyback with more than one person on your back? Like
just weighs you down. You can't move as fast.
Literally last week, and I had, like, one of the kids jumped on my back, and then the other one tried to, like, jump on his back and, like, have more piggyback, and you just can't even hardly do it. It's just, it's too awkward. The physics don't seem to work and whatever. And that's where we get with this piggybacking, is just be very careful. Obviously consult labels like we talked about and watch that, but you start throwing too many things in that tank and we start. So that'd be something to really watch, what you did this year, what worked for piggybackers, and what maybe, like, next year I'm not going to put that in the tank. I'm just going to put this in this, or
right. If it wrecked your efficacy on anything,
right,
it's probably worth the extra money for the next pass.
Just do it when you need it, or do it later. So those in certain ones, it does seem like we're figuring out which ones maybe are okay to throw in at that time and which ones you might want to wait. So,
and I guess I would say too, if it's anything biological that you're trying to put out there, it's probably not a good idea.
Probably not, because it's a lot of that biology, depending on where it's at, you didn't, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a lot of other things in there that it's probably not going to like being in the tank with.
So please read labels, read all of the stuff that you're doing the right thing, you know, consult all that, consult your person you buy chem from, or the person going to spray it, so that all that stuff, we kind of have a good game plan for next year, and then in the next couple weeks here, be watching how it worked for this year. And if you did different mixes, that'd be a good time to assess them. Like, did we need a little more firepower on this one that had not many weeds, or was that adequate? And kind of start game planning for next year.
And if it's going to rain, how long do we have until...
Rain fast on these is quite long. So that is a tough part to Roundup. You know, you're only 30 minutes rain fast where in List and Liberty, you want 4 hours ahead of that rain, which this time of year can be tricky. You get pop-up showers, you get...
Yeah, so if you, you know, black cloud, don't try to race.
Right, right. It is one of those where if you kind of got to be, you know, later afternoon or whenever showers could be rolling in, if there's a chance, be popping up your radar and then going, okay, maybe I got to take a break on this one or not spray, because it is that rain fast that you don't want to have to go back and redo it, or where I see where you get the rain too quickly in there and then it just half work. You know, usually it does work a little, but it's sort of that halfway.
Yeah, don't get the effect you want.
Right,
yeah.
And then you got half of dead weeds and they're hard to kill. So, but yeah, that be watching that one, because 4 hours, I mean, in a early summer afternoon, 4 hours could change a lot.
Right.
Being like beautiful, nice weather, all of a sudden a storm rolls in and
yeah, and then all your work is literally down the drain.
Yeah.
All right, so there's some things to think about if you're out there spraying beans and you're looking to use the Enlist technology and doing some piggybacking. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So today we're talking Bex Hybrids. They are expanding their seed production footprint, and they've recently acquired a Nebraska facility from Syngenta. So Scott Bex, as the family-owned business, markets seed corn in 23 states now, with Nebraska ranking 5th in the total volume of seed units sold. Once finalized, this latest acquisition will be the company's furthest west production facility. Bex, if you're not familiar, they're based out of Atlanta, Indiana. They are, as I said, in 23 states and the third largest seed brand in the U.S., dedicated to serving farmers throughout the Midwest. Did you know they were third, Todd?
I did, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you went to...
I've been down to Bex. See their facility, and it's...
Yeah.
It's neat. Well, I love seeing any seed facilities if they'll let me. So it's cool. Yeah. I love that their headquarters in Atlanta. I love cities like that aren't the, when you think of Atlanta, you think of Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
And I just love those cities that aren't they're in some other state with that same name, because
right. You can't just say, oh yeah, we're over to our facility in Atlanta.
Right. You know, something in a big company like that, like something had to happen at one point where something got shipped to Atlanta, Georgia, or like not, you know, a tour group ended up in there. I don't know what all could have happened, but yeah, it's a fun thing that they're in a city like that. That's
yeah.
Sort of
the
very far, you know, not even like a close second place, I'm sure, in population or size. Like
no, I would imagine that. Yeah, they're,
it's like
not even remotely close.
Right.
Just knowing where Atlanta, Indiana is. But, yeah, so this new production facility will not only serve Nebraska, but some of the seed produced there will be shipped back to places like Indiana and Ohio. So, yeah, I like I said, I didn't realize they were third. I knew they were up there, but I didn't know that they were in third place. So that is kind of a cool thing for them, and hopefully it works out. Seems every year more people are giving Bex a try, so... That's what's out there. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So as we roll into this 4th of July weekend, the old adage still gets quoted year after year, and that is knee high by the 4th of July. So why do we say that? Well, one of the earliest times the knee-high saying appeared in writing was the Summer Gazette on July 3rd, 1884. And it said, it has been considered that if corn was knee-high by the 4th of July, that the crop was sure and safe, the paper said. According to that rule, most of the corn will get there. It seems to be that the saying is not the goal, it's the minimum. Well, I don't think in 1884 they were planting corn by the 1st of May or even toward the end of April. I think it's safe to say they were planting much later than what we would consider the prime time now. So what is the, I guess, what would be the new way of saying that? So knee-high by the 4th of July was the indicator then. What's the indicator now? Well, depending on where you are in the country, currently you could probably find some corn silking in places like Kentucky. They're at 25% corn silking as of this year. Tennessee, 45%. North Carolina is 60% is silking. And in Texas, they are 72% silking. So when you think about that, I don't think knee-high really cuts it if you're in Texas or any of those states. Here in Wisconsin, I think we still kind of consider it that, but I've got stuff that's waist high.
My new minimum even is belt high by 4th of July. I mean, and I've tried to come up with just knee-high by the 4th of July. That thing stuck so well and it rhymes so good that, yeah, like waist-high by 4th of July or shoulder-high by 4th of July or chest-high by 4th. Like, they don't ring in, like, even using, like, Independence Day or different ones, nothing seems to sort of catch real well with that. So that saying really seemed to stick. And obviously now we kind of joke around about it where, you know, whose knee is it anyway and how tall?
Yeah, but yeah, that is true. If you're our coworker Nathan, who's 6 foot, seven, I don't know.
What he's 6'6".
6'6", yeah. His knee is in a different position than my knee.
Yes. So, and there too, like shoulder, using anything that. And like silking by the 4th of July, that's awesome. I mean, that'd be cool like for those southern states to have that. But yes, it is good knowing too, back in the day, that was the minimum, that it wasn't the goal. You know, it wasn't, sometimes we think of that like, you know, oh, we're really doing something. It's like, no, like if it doesn't, like basically what all those articles showed in the late 1800s was you needed to be that tall or this is not making grain or you've got problems out here
right. That
you got to fix. So,
yeah, so there you go. That's where knee-high comes from. And yeah, maybe we should be moving our thoughts to a little bit higher on the body for the 4th of July, but still gets said every year.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts, or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. And you can also listen on your computer and smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our cool beans. That's corny and some current events. So cool beans?
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. 73% of U.S. corn and 66% of soybeans are in good to excellent condition. So according to the USDA, we are up 3% at 73% of corn being in good to excellent shape, with 8% silking, and which is compared to a 5-year average of 6%. The 66% of soybeans being in good to excellent shape is unchanged, with 94% emerged, 17% blooming, and 3% at the pod set stage, which is all pretty close to normal. And so where is some of the best corn? Well, surprisingly, Pennsylvania is at 86, with its crop rated at good to excellent for corn. 30% of that falls into the excellent category. So they are currently, I guess, in the lead, you might say, for best corn in the country, followed right behind by Iowa. So Iowa has 22% that is excellent, but 85% of the total corn in that state was rated good to excellent.
And like all of our corn is grown in Iowa. So
right. That's
if that's doing well, you can obviously see why.
Should be a pretty good barometer for the crop this year. But unfortunately, that's corny, and thankfully not around here, but for the wheat crop, Kansas wheat yields are taking a hit due to some mosaic virus decimated fields. So apparently, according to K-State Extension specialists, the problem is showing up and expanding in other wheat producing states as well, but Kansas has taken the hit so far. Only 45 or 48, percent reaching good to excellent quality for their wheat in the state. Besides inclement weather, it was a small cigar-shaped pest, the wheat curl mite, that delivered big yield blows because they are a vector for wheat streak mosaic virus, which is one of the most destructive wheat disease complexes in the U.S. and around the world. Disease complex can be caused by several viruses, including the wheat streak mosaic virus, triticum mosaic virus, and wheat mosaic virus. So the issue is widespread beyond Kansas, but Kansas has taken a hit. It's been found in Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Texas as well. So hopefully the wheat crops in Wisconsin stay good, but yeah, you never know what kind of things can roll in on those crops from year to year. So now we will wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. So next year, 2026, marks the 250th anniversary of the United States. And so with that, the Mitchell Corn Palace is going to feature patriotic themes for their mural in 2026. So the design will coincide with the 250th anniversary. There'll be recruiting posters from World War II, Wright Brothers Aviation, American Eagle, American flag, symbols like that all over the murals. And while the current murals will still remain in place until this fall, they're already starting the planning process for figuring out how they're going to replace the current Corn Palace with the patriotic theme for next year. In October, November, when corn is harvested, is when they will probably make the change, and it will take about 60 acres of corn to cover the palace. So
that's awesome.
It doesn't say. I wonder, do they just have their own like cornfield right there?
Right, and it's all obviously different colored corn to make a design. So right, that too, it's got to be planted a certain way to get those shades that they can do. It's that is neat. It's a neat mural to do that, and that they can kind of change it and make different ones. And I just wonder what the corn, like after the mural too, what happens to it? Like, what do they do?
Right. After it like, sits on it the, just, yeah. Just, I mean, from last, this year's,
right.
It's been there since last fall. So
right.
Now, yeah.
What but in like, it? Do they ever get any that like sprouts up there or has problems? But
right. If it rains too much.
Yeah.
Or do they put some sort of sealant on it?
Right, or something to kind yeah. of hold back. Yeah,
it's a lot cool. of questions, not a yes. lot of answers.
Well, and like that too. Do they paint some of the cobs that to get?
Them? I'm sure some of the colors they
right.
have to.
Right, but it, a lot of it's kind of like a muted yellow browns kind of that they use to just make the mural. So it's really neat.
And maybe some of the stuff they, if they do seal it, maybe some of that
sure.
changes the shade a little bit
yep.
too.
Yep.
But yeah.
Never, and I, yeah, it's not close to us. It's like an 8-hour drive, but always wanted to go to the.
Yeah, and it changes every year. It's not like they just keep it
right
the same. I know my grandparents went there on some trip a number of years ago because I remember my grandma always had the Mitchell Corn Palace magnet on her fridge
okay.
from when they went. But yeah, I'm sure it's looked very different year to year since then. I mean, that was probably at least 20, 30 years ago that they would have went, so if not more than that.
The world's only corn palace.
World, yeah. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks, Meteor Todd.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about Enlist soybeans and the E3 technology, what you can maybe mix in if you need it for that follow-up spray on your beans. In our spotlight, we looked at Beck's expansion with the acquisition of a new seed production footprint in Nebraska. Ag History Minute, we talked about knee high by the 4th of July. Cool beans this week. A lot of good to excellent corn out there for the year. That's corny is Kansas wheat in other states taking a hit from some disease complexes. And our Field Good Friday was the patriotic theme that will be featured on the Mitchell Corn Palace in the Dakotas next year. So thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.